This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
Welcome in, everybody, to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Got a wonderful show for you today. Starting a little late today because of the holiday weekend. We apologize for that, but I am more than making up for it for you. I read an extremely interesting book over the weekend, and boy, we're gonna sit down with the author today, and we're going to chop it up. And folks, I'm telling you, you're going to want a copy of this book by the time we're done. The book is called Carmine and the 13th Avenue Boys Surviving Brooklyn's Columbo Mob. Craig McGuire is our guest. Let me tell you a little bit about Craig. He is a published author. Most recently, this book that we're talking about, it hit number one on Amazon's bestseller status in the biographies and memoirs of criminals category right away. Craig is also the author of Brooklyn's Most Wanted, the top 100 criminals, crooks, and creeps from the county of Kings, or of the Kings, and beyond the Ides, why March is the unluckiest month of all. That would be interesting to talk about in itself. A frequent speaker and podcast guest, Craig has been a successful writer, editor, designer, photographer, community reporter, new media journalist, and content creator for the last 30 years. Craig has also overseen content development for all different types of media, from web portals to newsletters to social media programs. Partial list of titles include Institutional Investor Magazine, InternetNews.com, Irish America, The Real Deal, Digital Media Buzz, Wall Street and Technology, PR Week, At Night Media, and more. And coming soon, Craig is currently working on a screenplay based on a true story involving a bizarre crime in South Brooklyn in the late 1980s. More details will be available shortly on that. Let's welcome to True Crime Tuesday, Craig McGuire. Craig, welcome in, my friend, to True Crime Tuesday.
Hey, Tim, how are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
Doing great, man. I tell you, I was absorbed by this book, and it's hard to get me absorbed into a book. But this man had... I'll tell you, the subject of our book here is Carmine has got me intrigued about his life in general. And it was a short life in the mob. I mean, born in 1957, obviously, and we'll go through his biography in a minute. I've got some general questions about the era of Brooklyn in which we're talking about here. But, man, I tell you, I talk about the level of absorption here, and I want to get to a point here. But I tell you, Craig, I'm kind of caught up in just the, not just the era of Brooklyn that we're covering here, but the fact that when we talk about real mob culture versus movie mob culture, it's really quite different, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Interestingly enough, Carmine was born in 1957, and historians mark that as the end of Brooklyn's golden age. Mm-hmm. So moving from the 60s into the 70s with the economic issues with the city, you sort of saw a downturn. The neighborhood got a little rougher around the edges. You know, it was a perfect, you know, incubator for young men, disillusioned men. Carmine was a high school dropout, you know, but a very popular guy, tough kid. And at this time on 13th Avenue, you had all five of the Italian organized crime families operating, but it was a Columbo stronghold. So you had this neighborhood culture, this insular neighborhood culture, you know, meeting this mob culture. And it was just like the perfect incubator to produce this really brutal landscape that Carmine got caught up in very, very quickly. this is really a collection of Carmine and Brialy stories. So it was just from the very first conversation I had with Carmine, very intriguing. He's a tough guy, but he's a very charismatic guy, very amiable, easy to get along with. Just really pulls you in with these remarkable stories that have kind of twists and turns in them. And at the same time, you know, from very young, he was a bookmaker. He was dealing football sheets at a time. This was pre legalized gambling at a time when they still did before the lotto. There's a good section there about the numbers, the Italian street lottery. And it was just such a sprawling landscape. You know, along 13th Avenue, you had a dozen clubs. Mm-hmm. And then within a 2 mile radius, you had some of these, you know, infamous mob clubs for the Gambinos, for the Columbos. And, you know, at any given time, thousands of these guys floating in and out of these clubs, doing all different types of scams. So it was a wild ride just to sit there and listen about it. And I hope I did him justice with the, with his stories.
I believe you did. I want to rewind a little bit here, though, Craig, in that when we started out in 1957, it seems like Brooklyn at the time is a neighborhood that's turning. You mentioned in the book that Brooklyn at this time is a place where it's still relatively safe. We don't think of it being a big deal at this time to be able to take the subway and not worry about your life or your possessions or being able to hop a train and have to worry about being jumped.
Yes. If you think about Brooklyn, it's a tapestry of all different neighborhoods. And some of the South Brooklyn neighborhoods like Bensonhurst, Dyker Heights, Fort Hamilton, they're more residential. So there's a little bit more stability there than you have in some of the more commercial districts like down in the Gowanus and Coney Island. There was a lawlessness there. There was, especially as drugs started to creep in. There's some fascinating stories. Carmine was a young player in the Brooklyn Concrete Tackle League. So they used to play, and I remember this when I was a kid because I grew up in the area, and they used to play tackle football in on asphalt. So it was pretty fascinating.
Which made me hurt just reading this because, I mean, I played football for years, and to think that you would actually play football on a concrete slab made me hurt just reading it. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt there.
Please do. Yeah. Sometimes these stories are just so easy to jump in on. So when he was playing, he was of the younger generation, and then he had older brothers and friends. And again, it was a very insular community. Everybody was out playing in the street. It was still part of stoop culture, still playing stickball. Stickball leagues were still very popular. You had the Italian street festivals and the fairs. And then I interviewed some of the older guys, and they talked about how you had, especially around this time, the 70s, more drugs were coming into the neighborhood. So and the combination of that and the economic downturn, was harder to get jobs. It was just a little tighter. So it became a darker landscape. And this is just the type of environment Carmine was coming of age.
Now, you and I had talked before the show. You grew up in the Brooklyn area. And you would, I mean, obviously you're doing well for yourself. You're an author. You didn't go down that road. So I don't hesitate to ask the question at all, but you know, there's that fine line, you know, there's people you stay away from in the neighborhood. There's people if you get mixed up with, you know, you may go down that road. So talk to me a little bit here, for a second here about what it is that is that fine line and what keeps you on the straight and narrow and what takes you down that dark path?
Great question. For context, I was born in 71. Carmine was born in 57. Mm-hmm. And he actually grew up, I grew up within a half mile of each other. We actually went to the same elementary school.
Really?
Which is pretty interesting. Huh. And it hadn't changed much. PS204. I'm by no means a tough guy. I'm not a wise guy, a gangster. I wasn't ever involved with that. Just regular neighborhood kid. But one thing we bring up in the book is the neighborhood is so dense and it's so packed, and it's so communal. You know that so many people, everybody knows somebody who's involved in the rackets. whether it was playing the numbers or the guy in the corner. There used to be OTBs all over the place, off-track betting. So there's a lot of gambling in the neighborhood all over the place. There, you knew where the card game was. You knew where the dice game was. You didn't go there. It was a lawlessness, but it was also it wasn't that much a depraved scene. There was some kind of structure. A lot of people until the 80s, really the 80s came, and then there was a lot more cocaine involved. Mm-hmm. There was a lot more heavier drugs, you know, a lot more junkies. It wasn't as bad as it was in some of the like the South Bronx neighborhoods that you have, but it was a pretty dark place. A lot of attributed to drugs. But they were also there. I was fortunate enough to have a strong family, strong support network, and Carmine did as well. You know, that's one of the distinctions of Carmine's life path. Mm-hmm. He always had a strong family, had the love of his wife who was with him throughout thick and thin, his kids. And that's pretty rare when you see in the rackets. You know, their personal lives, you know, tend to unravel. Integrity was a big thing with Carmine. And it's kind of sometimes it seems counterintuitive. But then when you think about it, I mean, when you're dealing with criminals, there has to be some level of trust involved. And when you violate this trust, you know, then, you know, that's bad business all around. So there was a lot of it in the neighborhood. There's also a lot of opportunity, too. You know, living in South Brooklyn is still part of New York City. It's part of the center of the world.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a lot of opportunity for young kids.
And you've brought up a lot of good points here, Craig. I mean, it's you can only forge so many excuses. Okay. So if it's not the family life, because let's face it, Carmine had. He had a strong family background. I mean, you talk in the book about how his father was right on top of him. If he did something, you know, nothing was ever good enough for his father. One, you know, you talk about how when he was playing in that concrete football league, which makes my knees and my back hurt thinking about it right now. But he'd score 4 touchdowns in a game. And it was, why didn't you score 5? You know, he had the opportunity to score 5. Why didn't you score 5? Or, you know, if he made a mistake, well, his father was all over him like white on rice, right? So dad was hard on him, but he was there. That, you know, so, you know, there's a lot of mobsters that could say, well, dad wasn't there, you know, and that's why they were in the mob, because it was family. So there's excuse number one thrown out the door. Family was there, so he can't blame it on family. There's other motivations as well. Well, you know, we really grew up poor, but we didn't have much. Well, it seems like both mom and dad were working so that they could at least try to provide some sort of life. So yeah, I don't know that you can really blame that, because mom and dad were trying. I mean, sure, they didn't have much, but mom and dad were trying. So I don't know that you can really use that either. You know, I mean, it seems like the whole family were go-getters, right?
Yes. And Carmine is too in his own way. Remember, he dropped out of Neutrik High School, but he was very capable and he was very useful. He's highly intelligent. He's very charismatic. He has a lot of the people skills that he could have been very, very successful in business. It just happened to be the landscape he was involved with. And it was a slow, gradual roll into organized crime. He didn't become, you know, a street level associate for the Columbos overnight. He actually started very young. He was he was a valet at Pastel's nightclub, which is this famous, you know, South Brooklyn nightclub that was just a magnet for young organized crime guys. And he was standing outside parking their cars. So mm-hmm. that visibility there, he's a good looking guy. And he was in a lot of fights. You know, there, everyone I talked to seemed to have some kind of crazy story about a fight that Carmine was involved with. And then everybody would come out and they would watch these fights. And it was like a real, you could just envision this, this like Hollywood scene unfolding. Right. And then there was a great story that we talked about with Tommy Dades. Detective Tommy Dades, you know, is the one who introduced me to Carmine. about Carmine fighting this young boxer to a standstill, and then afterwards going up and shaking his hands. And that was kind of unheard of. You know, it was like after a fight, but because he had this kind of integrity about him. And then people pick up on that because it's, you know, Brooklyn has an edge to it, and it's very visceral. It's very in your face. You know, it's actions that turn heads. So he was highly recruited by several other, you know, ranking and future ranking gangsters in different crews. It just turned out like a matter of circumstance where he was involved with a beef with an organized crime figure. And at that point, because of the rules, you know, he was left out in the cold, and that's it. You know, all the made guys have to set him up, actually, even if it's his friends. So he wound up Carmine Sessa, actually, who was captain and future consigliere of the Columbos. He actually orchestrated this scenario to bring Carmine in. So Carmine didn't even realize it, that now he was associated with Carmine Sesta. And that was it. You know, then he was in. And then he even mentions how he frequented this popular bar on 13th Avenue called Nettie's. And it was a regular bar, you know, so regular people could kind of go in there, but not really. But neighborhood people were in there. If you weren't from the neighborhood, you would have a hard time in there. But there was a lot of criminal activity in there. And it was low level stuff. It was, you know, doing some golfers. It was, you know, errands. And then those become as they start to recognize Carmine's capabilities. He was a very strong man. He was a good street fighter. He could take a punch. He could give it. So they found him very useful, especially with his integrity. And they felt they could trust him.
You know, and so we kind of getting back to this point, as you're pointing out, he's got this. Not only does he have the charm, as you keep pointing out throughout the book, he's got this charm that wins over these gangsters and mobsters, but it seems like he's got this solid background that not only lures these mobsters to them, that says, hey, you know what, this guy's a stand-up guy, it kind of attracts them, but it really doesn't give him an excuse to stay with it. You know, I mean, he's as you point out, he's got a wife and kids. Well, you could say, well, I need to earn. Well, but you could also earn in a legit job, too. There's a interesting story you have in the book where he's in. I'm trying to remember the name of the Chinese restaurant where they're there for. It was a drinks that they were there for. And he was.
Yes.
Yeah, and he ends up getting hit with a wet rag.
Yes,
he and his date, and it ends up turning, of course, into a fight. And the place is owned by a mobster, of course, that he's not aware of, and of course he has to make amends. But it's a serious mobster that owns this place, and he doesn't mess around. And he's in big time trouble. So he's got to, you know, he gets advice from another friend who's made. And he needs to really go in there and just play it straight. And somewhere in there, he ends up getting his union card and offer for a job at an ungodly amount of money.
Yeah, that's such a great microcosm, and it gives you Carmine in a nutshell. It was Christy Tick, Funeri's. Owned the 19th hole on 14th Avenue, 86th Street. And he also owned the Chinese restaurant next door. And he was, Christy Tick was actually one of the high ranking, wise guys who was, convicted in the commission trial. Mm-hmm. So that tells you how high up he was. And I think he was just released from jail a couple of years ago at like 99 years old.
Wow.
But he was a pretty fierce guy. He helped incubate the bypass gang. You know, he was mentor for Gaspipe Casso and Vicar Musso. So, you know, he was about as dangerous as they get. So and Carmine had no idea about this, but he was on a date with his girl and his friends. And then the drunk bartender, you know, wouldn't stop cursing and acting inappropriate. And then he it turned into this wild brawl. And then the next day when he got called in, you know, he was in a room with Christy Tick and Tick's bodyguard, Carmine, and the four restaurant workers. And they kept gibbering at him and he couldn't stop laughing, even though, you know, this could have had disastrous lethal consequences. He couldn't stop laughing. Guy takes him out of the room three times. He couldn't stop laughing. And then finally, at the ultimate moment, Christy Tick starts laughing. So it's these kind of things that are like unless he told it to me and I know it happened. It's just like it's so unbelievable. And then he was so endearing that he gave him a job. He gave him a job working on asbestos removal. Mm-hmm. With a union car, which is a really, you know, plum gig in the 1980s. So yeah, it's just a great story. And we have a couple more stories like that in the book where they would say only you, Carmine. So many people I hear from other people, they're like only you, Carmine, you know?
Yeah. And so it seems like, I hate to use the line from the movie, but you know, it's one of those things where, you know, just when he thinks he's out, they pull him back in. You know, it's he gets the easy out. He gets the, you know what, you could have this life. You could go off. You could actually become legit. You could go do something, but you know, there's a little something pulling you back in. There's another movie too that's an interesting parallel here, and I want to bring this up with you too. There's another mobster that. There's that Carmine kind of parallels, and you bring it up in the book. Rest in peace to Ray Liotta. He played Henry Hill in Goodfellas, and Carmine kind of parallels Henry Hill in that he'll never be made because he's not, you know, he's not pure blooded, so to speak. He is invited, however, to join a family. Can you tell us a little bit about the consequence in which Carmine has to be invited into a family?
You know, we do go through that in the book. It's interesting that you mentioned that because a lot of their origins are so there are a lot of corollaries there. You know, both Italian, Irish, which was a common mix growing up. That's actually my background as well. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, they were both valets early on. So that kind of recognition you had, Henry Hill was parking cars at the cab stand. You know, Carmine was doing at Pastels. It's that younger level. Also, in these different, you know, they were different time periods. Slightly, so they don't exactly overlap. Mm-hmm. But it's that same recruitment, because just like in any other, you know, walk of life and profession, you know, there is a dearth of talent, and you're always looking for a good earner, someone you could trust. So you had same thing with Henry Hill, even though you couldn't ultimately be inducted as a made member, you could still be highly useful. And the more members you have of your crew, the stronger you are, the more earning potential you have, because it's, you know, very cutthroat kind of business. So always looking. So it's in their best interest to help groom these young men and help bring them along. There's a divergence there, you know, as these two young men get older. You know, Henry Hill was a murderer. Carmine was not a murderer. He never killed anyone. And that was proven out. Well, you know, when you go through the witness protection program, you have to admit to all of your crimes. And if there are any crimes that come up afterwards, they can invalidate the deal and then, you know, ultimately, you know, send you to prison.
Yeah.
And then there's also Henry Hill was heavily involved in narcotics trafficking. Carmine was not involved in Carmine's trafficking. He was a bookmaker. He was a loan shark. He was an armed robber, a hijacker. And also he's very big with the credit card scams. That's a very interesting subject to touch on. And ultimately, it was not that formal type of Hollywood style indoctrination. Mm-hmm. It was more of an informal kind of bringing him along until there was that moment where, you know, Carmine Sessa brought him into his crew. And then it's official. Carmine talks about that sense of, accomplishment, because he bought into it early on. He bought into this whole code. He grew up watching these guys on the air. These are the tough guys. These are the guys to look up to, just because there's not that many other types of role models in the area. You know, he talks about his father. His father had a strong influence on him, and his father was a man of integrity. Mm-hmm. And his father hated the wise guys. But I mean, you're there. You can't avoid them. You know, so he's out on the avenue all day. He's in the park all night. So eventually, just gravitated toward by proximity.
Yeah.
And then became involved more and more with different crimes.
You mentioned you want to touch on some of those different crimes. I tell you what, let's do this, Craig. Let's take our break right now. When we come back, let's touch on some of the different crimes that Carmine got into, because it's really quite interesting how Carmine branches out. He doesn't stay in one lane, so to speak. He really does branch out, and it really starts with, as you mentioned, as he becomes a valet, he gets to know some of these different wise guys, and they start to notice his hustle, so to speak. And he becomes the man. He becomes the man to get to know. He starts to network from there. And then he really starts to get into getting to know these guys and start doing favors for them. And then he branches out. And some of the things that he gets into are interesting. Like you said, he never killed anybody. And I'm interested to find out why and how he avoided that. So we'll get into that when we come back. Our guest is Craig McGuire, and the book, like I said, absolutely fascinating. The book is Carmine and the 13th Avenue Boys, Surviving Brooklyn's Columbo Mob. And the book was written with Carmine Imbrialli. Am I saying that right, Imbrialli?
Yes, Carmine Imbrialli.
Correct. And it's out by Wild Blue Press. We'll have a link for it in the description of this program. Craig, do you have a website that you want to plug with this?
My personal site, craigmcguire.com. You could check that out to see all different updates.
Okay.
And please, Wild Blue Press has a lot of great content coming out.
Okay.
I recommend.
So we'll send you there to wildbluepress.com for a copy of the book. Also, it's available on amazon.com. We'll have all the different links in the description of this program, so you can pick up a copy. By all means, pick up a copy of this book. I'm telling you, folks, I was riveted throughout the weekend reading this book, and you do need to pick up a copy of this book. It is fascinating. It is jam-packed, full of stuff that you think you know the mob before you sit down and you read this book. But I'm telling you, it's fascinating, especially every mob family you think you've ever read something about is involved in this little slice of Brooklyn here in this book. So when we come back, we'll talk more with Craig McGuire about Carmine and his exploits as he's coming up through the system in Brooklyn. We'll do that when we come back in the best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs. In all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Exciting, exciting program today as we're talking about Carmine Imbrialli. And the book is called Carmine and the 13th Avenue Boys, The author is Craig McGuire, and we will have links for the book in the description of this program. Wild Blue, I don't know why it's hard for me to say this, Craig. Wildbluepress.com. It shouldn't be that hard for me to say that. Also, there's a link to Amazon.com for you to get the book as well. I'll tell you, Craig, like I said, it was engaging reading for me all weekend long. I was intrigued with Carmine's rise, so to speak. As we were talking about before the break, we were talking about how he started off as a valet, and he started to make those crucial networking. And I don't even know that networking was a thing back then. You just knew to run into one guy and another and then do favors. And it started when, as he's a valet at, was it Pastels that he was the valet at? Okay, so as he's a valet at Pastels, bouncers are let's just call it as it is, glorified meatheads. They're not knowing one gangster from another, one mobster from another, and they're not knowing what position they're in. And a lot of the big ones are coming into Pastels, and they're saying, whoa, 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 you're not on the list. Well, it's at this point Carmine's got to sort things out, you know, and he does it in a hurry because he knows who these guys are. Well, as he's doing these favors for these guys, they're tipping big time. But it's more than just about tips for Carmine. He realizes, hey, I can get much, much more out of this. And so begins the career of Carmine, realizing, hey, I can make a pretty good living here if I play my cards right. And he's really young here. How old is Carmine when he realizes, hey, I got a future ahead of me if I play my cards right?
He was in his mid-teens, and Tim, I love the way you put it before about, you know, this book is a slice or many slices of South Brooklyn from the era. And you touch on a point there. When you're online outside the club, these guys, whether they're made members or just associates or they're involved, they're not allowed to talk about relationships. You're not allowed to, because that's basically, you know, tipping off and giving intel on the hierarchy and how crews are structured. So you can't say that. So you had instances where you had these already violent, you know, young men, maybe drunk online, you know, belligerent, want to get into the club. The line's running down the block. They're not used to hearing no, you know, so it's a very combustible situation. Carmine springs off the chair, goes, tells the bouncer, this guy's good. You better let him in. Mm-hmm. And that happens several times. He gets noticed. He does favors. It's all about doing favors. Mm-hmm. At the same time, during the day, Carmine's got to make money. So him and several of his friends, they're sticking up pot dealers. You know, that was a favorite pastime for them because it was easy. They're an easy mark. They're not going to go to the cops. You know, they're usually not tough guys like him. But you can only rob so many pot deals before they see you coming. True. And so he needed more stable forms of income. And some of the things he gravitated to was some of these, you know, running these errands, but then also with the football sheets, which they used to have, you know, back in the day, low level parlay gambling. And that got him into bookmaking, low level bookmaking. But then again, that's also when you're dealing with gamblers and degenerate gamblers. I remember Carmine, he was a violent man, but he wasn't violent by nature. Mm-hmm. So he would cap the amount of the bets or the amount that his customers would play with him. Because if you got to get $500 out of a guy, it's different if the guy owes you $10,000.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to hurt people. He's not cruel by nature, from what I gather. So he had that sideline. And then there was the robberies. Yeah, he did a lot. He did many armed robberies, and there was some bank robberies that he was able to get in on. Those were difficult to be included on because they were higher value robberies, and you had to, you know, be brought in by some of the made guys. And a lot of these things you don't see nowadays, especially on the gambling side, you know. And then we see credit cards. And car theft. You know, this was right when Carmine was coming of age. They installed the VIN, vehicle identification numbers, on the cars. Mm-hmm. So that was a security measure. So they figured out you could steal the cars and then strip the VIN numbers. And then take the VIN numbers off of junk and you got a brand new car. Legal cars. So you had these, you know, hundreds of chop shops springing up all over the city, and organized crime was heavily involved in. It was, you know, the golden age of the, they called them tag jobs. And Carmine was a car thief, and there weren't the sophisticated alarm systems. So Carmine goes into detail about the tools he used, about the, his approach. And then we had the advent of credit cards and the rise of credit cards. And this is during a period where they had the knuckle busters, where you put the card on and you had the and you ran it back. And there was no security on it. I think they put out a book a month of expired cards or stolen cars. You could theoretically call in, but there was no liability on the cards. So if someone went into a shop, used a stolen credit card, the merchant wasn't liable for the theft. The bank was. And the bank was fine with that for a long time because everyone was making so much money. You no longer had to have cash. You could use credit. So merchants were able to use more. Banks could charge more fees. And then the credit card crime was just a cost of doing business. And it exploded on 13th Avenue. All the different scams that Carmen was involved with to be able to get the cards, manufacture the cards, get the numbers, get some of his customers who owed money, he would use they would give him their cards, just all these different rackets. Now, at the same time, he's also working. Maybe he has a union job for a while, or he's working at the Hunts Point Market. So he had some legitimate work. You know, it's interestingly enough, he would say, you know, it was a lot of criminal activity, but it was work. Every day you have to get up and you have to find that hustle. What card am I going to use to? Today, who am I going to rob today? What's the scam? Because just like everybody else, he's got to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
So this book goes through all these different slices of organized crime. So it was-
you bring up something interesting there, Craig, in that he's, you know, he does say it's work every day. You got to get up. You got to find your hustle. And it would have been easy for him to say, you know, I can turn to drugs. I can deal drugs. It's easy money. I can get up. I can be a hired killer. It's easy money. You know, I get up, I off a guy, it's what, 5, 10, 15 grand. And, you know, and then I wait for my next job. What kept Carmine from getting off that daily grind, that daily hustle, and going to easier money?
We touched on it earlier. I think a lot of it, it's a mix of his family background, the influence of his father. He did have a stable family. He had a wife that he loves and adores to this day. He had children. He had a broad extended family. He was involved with the rackets. Once you go through that door, you become a different type of person. He was during the Third Colombo War. He was required to go with his crew in hunting parties at night, looking for them armed. So. And he was hoping that he would never have to be called upon to murder anybody. Fortunately enough, his crew chief kind of bungled everything, and they were going out in the middle of the night when nobody's out. But yeah, so he was earning enough in other areas and involved in so many different things. I think it was expected ultimately for him, but it wasn't a running prerequisite. You know, it wasn't like you have to, you know, go kill somebody now. And plus, remember, he wasn't going to be made. So there's not that extra level of security that they felt they needed him to prove, go kill somebody so we know. But it was swimming with sharks. There's a lot of treachery that he was involved with, you know, especially with his crew.
Is there a difference in his business and in the reality of the mob? Is a good earner not a good killer, and vice versa? Do they separate very much? Keep that boundary there?
You know, I think so. One of the interesting stories, he says, as he moved up from pot dealers, he started to rob bookmakers because there are a lot of unaffiliated bookmakers because gambling was so rampant, and there wasn't even lotto at this point. It didn't come in for there was off track betting, but it was all street gambling. So you had a lot of guys making money and they weren't kicking up to anyone. So he would be able to and he says they're usually the loudest guy in the bar. So you can pin them out 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
So the difference with Carmine, though, is Carmine knew who to call to check if this guy was legitimate. So yeah. then he would be able to, and then he would gamble with them, you know, pay a little bit, then gamble more with them, pay a little bit, then gamble a lot with them. He had all these interesting scams going, but he was so busy and so involved in many different rackets that didn't necessarily involve, the brutality that takes to be a murderer. So I think they are different mindsets. Can they be combined in the same person? I think so. But you'll see, and I bring up the bookmakers. The bookmaker's has different skills because of his intelligence, mm-hmm. his people skills, his way to organize money, keep it in his head, his people skills to be able to deal up the chain and with his customers. That's a different guy than a leg breaker, who's more point and shoot. So guys, you know, kind of get specialized in there. And plus, you know, you don't want everybody involved. If you're a captain, you want the less people involved with your murder schemes as possible. So you tend to use the same guys reliably, from what I know.
Yeah, that's true. In 1975, James Ida almost gave Carmine his first break. And gives him $1,500 to buy a suit, and kind of inferring that, hey kid, you know, want to take you under my wing, want to get you in the easy way, want to kind of bring you into my crew. Carmine doesn't get the hint, does he?
You know, they weren't Columbos. Joe and Jimmy Ida, eventually captains, were still operating on 13th Avenue, which was fascinating because, you know, you think about turf, the concept of turf warfare. Mm-hmm. But no, you had these guys, you know, operating side by side from each other. Well, the Columbos were a more violent family. And Jimmy Ida was always outside. He actually had his own storefront across the street from a shop, a variety store that his brother owns. So Carmine was always on the avenue. Jimmy took a shine to him. And like you said, he told Carmine, go clean yourself up and then let's go to dinner. And Carmine being Carmine, he ran down to Florida. He blew the money and then he came back. And he always regretted not going with Jimmy Ida because there's more of a he was still a gangster, but there's more of a class and integrity and a trust there. And it proves out, you know, how the Columbos devolved into total chaos and self-destruction. Mm-hmm. And he feels things would have went much differently. But again, life moves so fast on 13th Avenue. He just got sucked in. And before he even realized that he was aligned with the under Carmine Cessus. So
now he still technically owed Jimmy Ida the $1,500. Did he ever really get it back to him?
He was worried. He was worried. And he swore Jim. He's like, I'll get you the money. He never had to pay him back. You know, Jimmy did take such a shine to Carmine, mm-hmm. He never did eventually.
Interesting. You know, there's times in the book where it seems like Carmine's playing all sides. Like, you know, even though he's not dedicated to one crew, he really is playing different crews and maybe even playing them against each other. Is there a time, and I get the idea that he is worried. He's worried for himself first, but is he ever worried about other crews? And follow me when I say this here, Craig.
Sure.
Is he ever worried about the fact that he's going to have to do business eventually with one or two crews and keep them loyal to him? Does he ever say, I favor this crew over this crew, and eventually I don't want to piss off this crew? Did he ever sit down with you and say, you know what, I was more partial to this crew and this crew or this family and this family, and I really never wanted to cross them?
You know, this is a very interesting subject that you touch on. I see Carmine, and this is my perspective. Again, I'm not a mob historian. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not a tough guy. I don't have firsthand knowledge. But from my perspective, and having spent, you know, over two years with Carmine, I get the sense of he was in survival mode. It was just that insanity, and the number of murders that kept, and the level of violence that he witnessed is staggering. So you see a lot of I do see it as a survival mode situation. Now, when the Third Colombo War broke out, now this was by far the most violent, dysfunctional family. This is, again, the third civil war for this family.
Yeah.
And it broke out in bloody fashion on the streets of Brooklyn. But this is at a time when all five families are exploding in their business. There's just so much activity going on, and business doesn't stop. So all these activity, and remember, they're so closely interwoven throughout the fabric of Brooklyn. They're all in the same clubs. They're all outside. They're all the feasts, all the gatherings, all the different gambling dens. So you have to go and you have to do business, go from bar to bar, whether you have a scheme with this guy and you're on Bath Avenue, or you with this guy in Gravesend, or 13th Avenue, 18th Avenue. You're going around. Business doesn't stop. Mm-hmm. So he has to go. And, you know, he said at this time, remember, no cell phones. So they're all doing business with beepers and payphones. So he's switching up his beepers. He's switching up his spots. He's got to pick up his money here. And at the same time, you know, some of his childhood friends are on different sides during the war. And there's one of his close friends when he was younger, Frankie Notch. He tells a story of, you know, going into a bathroom and his father's in there. You know, and he should have done something there as per the rules of the family. You're at war with this side, you know, so something has to get done. And he let it go, you know, and he's saying there were times where he saw some other guys and it should have been reported. But then it wasn't only Carmine. You had a lot of these guys that were switching sides and they should have been killed for that. But they, you know, weren't. Some of them paid those consequences. Then you had murders that were carried out that weren't. Family business. They were rivalries. They had to do with the different captains having trying to get back at somebody. So it really didn't have anything to do with the actual war. It was just an opportunity to kill a rival. And then when that happened, Carmine had a very close friend of his murdered, Joe Brewster. And Joe Brewster was a made man, and he was very popular on 13th Avenue. And mm-hmm. and Greg Scarpa orchestrated his murder, and everybody realized what that was. That wasn't family business. That was, you know, Greg Scarpa eliminating a rival, a threat. And that was really it crystallized for not just Carmine, so many other guys, like, what's going on with this thing? And then you have, you know, you're supposed to adhere to this code, you know. And then that's when everything really started to unravel over the next, you know, couple of years.
Yeah, when people pick up the book, they'll realize that Greg Scarpa is not what you would call the most upstanding mobster out there, and really is a polarizing figure.
He was a giant on 13th Avenue, and there are several really good books. You know, I cite them in my about Greg Scarpa. Greg Scarpa for decades was an informer for the FBI in two different periods. You know, most, if not all, some of the major mob trials, mm-hmm. a lot of the wiretaps were authorized because of intelligence that Greg Scarpa, even against the own boss of his family. And his club was right across the street, the Wimpy Boys. And he did not like Carmine. And they had some run-ins. And he actually, he marked Carmine for death, one of two murder plots, the other by members of his own crew due to jealousy and different long-running issues. Greg Scarpa was a menace, was a dangerous man on 13th Avenue. And he wanted Carmine dead.
Well, and that started over a bet, didn't it? Over a bet that he wouldn't pay off with Carmine?
There were multiple incidents. You know, Greg Scarpa was a narcissist. He wanted complete allegiance, obedience. He wanted complete deference, you know. And Carmine was not really the kind of guy to bend the knee, mm-hmm. you know. So there was going to be there was going to be some friction there. There was one instance where he beat up a young neighborhood guy, was inappropriate to Carmine's niece. So Carmine beat the hell out of him in front of the Wimpy Boys. And Greg Scarpa didn't take that. You can't, he could beat people up in front of his club, but you can't. And then there were some, and then there was that the incident where his friend placed a large bet. And then when his friend went to pay up, Greg Scarpa's son didn't want to pay. And then they and Greg didn't want to pay. He wanted to see the money first. And it's like, that's not how it happens. If you book the bet, you have to pay. If you want to see the money, you got to, you have that conversation ahead of time. So there was that. And there were other incidents over the years that just rubbed Greg Scarpa the wrong way. And you have to think, you're taking your life in your hands, because he did murder people for slights like that in his own club. So
to me, that's crazy that, okay, here's a guy who's informing for the FBI, but at the same time, he's literally getting away with murder.
Yeah, he played both sides. And then you'll see, especially in some of these other the names of the book escape my head, but there I cite them in my book. It's really a fascinating, you know, case study and duplicity and how he was playing both sides. He was paid by the government bounties for certain information. Then he was getting information and he was informing on people to get them out of the way. So any way you could eat, whether he killed them or they went away to prison, he still eliminated an enemy. And he did this for decades. And it was a pretty remarkable career.
And they just took him at his word. Unbelievable. So let's talk a little bit about, as Carmine starts to get a little bit into the weeds. And we won't give away too much towards the end of the book because we want people, of course, to find out for themselves what's going on with Carmine towards the end of the book. But as Carmine gets into the weeds, so to speak, he does get marked for murder by a Colombo soldier, and Carmine's unaffiliated at this point.
Correct.
So at this point, he does need to, as we mentioned, he does need to get protection, and he gets that from Carmine Sessa, and becomes an associate of the Colombo family. Timely or the beginning of the downfall of him, do you think?
That was, and he'll be the first to admit it. That was the point where, you know, he felt like he had achieved something. He was accepted. So remember, he was a high school dropout. You know, he was always reaching for something, to be part of something. And finally, he was part of something. Unfortunately, over the next decade and a half, you know, his eyes were open to, you know, how laughably insincere that is. And later on, during the war, his protection from Carmine Sessa sort of, you know, evaporates when Carmine Sessa is on the run. Mm-hmm. And then Carmine's younger brother was installed as captain, which he really didn't earn his stripes.
Okay.
In Carmine's eyes and in many people's eyes. And there was a big rivalry between those two. So that was one murder plot against Carmine. And then also with Greg Scarpa. And this is also at a time, so he gets taken off, Carmine gets taken off the streets, and he's facing a RICO case. So he's looking to go away for life with no real financial stability for his family. And the earlier times when he was incarcerated, they didn't step up to help him. So his family is in peril. He's facing life in prison. And then he learns that there are two unsanctioned murder plots on him. And there's a pretty provocative scene in the book where he's almost murdered. And this is right before he gets taken off the street. So when before that, you know, he gets the option to cooperate. He's got to think about it, you know, even though he doesn't believe in the code, this is a big decision to make. But it's not, they're not just going to take him on at his word. He has to wear a wire. Mm-hmm. So he has to go out on the street and he has to wear a wire, you know, dozens of times. And his wire is actually able to get the authorization to plant a bug in a wise guy's car, Joey Ambrosino. And that bug yielded some of the most damning testimony of the war and helped authorize other wiretaps and unlock just a trove of information. He testified in half a dozen mob trials. And he really did, you know, he helped put away, you know, 40 wise guys. Wow. And he did do his part. And then he went into the witness protection program.
Wow. So sitting with Carmine for 2 years and getting to know Carmine Imbrialli, is there a part of him that has ever said to you, Craig, if I had it all over to do it all over again, would I would take a different route? I'd do something else?
Yes. And it's very interesting, Tim. Ever since we went through this 2 years during the pandemic, I was getting the calls from him in an unrestricted number because in different locations. And then you get to know a man. You know, there's so much material that's not in the book. We have so much because you can only fit so much in a 250-page book.
Okay.
And then also afterwards, Carmine, now that he's in content creation mode, kind of, he's revisiting things and he found a whole trove of information. So there's all this other great material. And then it puts you back in his perspective because we have to go over it. He didn't realize the amount of work it takes to do a book, the initial research and fact finding, you know, the corroboration and then the editing. And then but you get to know, man. And then especially when we're talking about his early life and his passion was sports. And he was a very successful youth athlete. In multiple sports. I mean, he was from stickball, baseball, football, you know, multi-sport athlete, even coaching, you know. So he said if he had his druthers, he could see himself, you know, a career in sports or athletics or maybe, you know, if it were nowadays, you know, personal training,
yeah.
You know, any of these various disciplines. He has the physique for it, the charismatic. I could see him owning his own gym on 13th Avenue.
Wow. Huh. Well, that would definitely be interesting. Is there a detail that didn't make the book that was absolutely shocking that came out after the book, maybe, that you wish you would have put in the book?
That's a great question. I do know we go into, it's so fascinating because there are so many different areas of the culture that we go into. When he was a young man, and he was arrested for car theft at a time when they really slap you on the wrist. You know, you get probation.
Yep.
They gave him the option to go to Daytop, which was, drug rehabilitation camp for youth offenders, even though he was not it wasn't a drug crime. So just that whole fascinating subculture that came. And I had several friends that went through it. There was Daytop. There was another one who had been incarcerated and they took that deal or, you know, they went into the service. But really that whole culture, you know, is rich for exploring all the stories. And he had some pretty, you know, galling accounts about, you know, treatment in there. I would have liked to have gone more into when he went into the witness protection program, because that was fascinating for me because he was able to with the strength of his family and he was able to and he floundered at first. It's very difficult. You don't have a high school education.
Yeah.
You don't have a background. It's like you're going out into the unknown and you're ill equipped. So how do you feel it? So he goes through a series of these jobs that they're pretty comedic in some of his hijinks. But then you think about how dramatic the backdrop is, you know, he has a large family discovery and he eventually lands in real estate and he's been very successful for it.
Let's go.
So there's always that whole transition piece, but he calls me constantly. He has all these, you know, additional materials and episodes that I'd like to go dig deeper into, maybe do a series.
That would be very interesting, especially the life after. I know with Daytop, there's the insinuation there, more than an insinuation, I'll put it that way, Craig, that there was more to Daytop than just a drug treatment program, that there was really some nefarious stuff going on there. And I agree. I think if there would just more of an investigation of what was really going on at Daytop would be interesting, really interesting, because you know that there was things going on there that weren't on the up and up, for lack of a better term. So I think some of those stories from there, I think he probably held out on you as to what really some of the more nefarious, I keep using the word nefarious, but that's the word that's hitting me at the time, things that were going on there. I really do think it was a cover for other activities at the time.
You know, I believe Carmine was better equipped to deal with that situation just because he was such a tough kid.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and other kids that aren't as tough and are drug addicted, I could imagine them having a much more harrowing experience. He talks about a lot of the brainwashing and then how they would shave your head if you make you wear a dress and some other kind of, you know, which was supposed to be part of the program that he just wouldn't participate in. Mm-hmm. So he was supposed to, they actually extended his stay. So he got stuck in there longer than he was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Just cause he wouldn't fall into line. But I agree with you. I think I don't know enough about it. I find it fascinating. I think they, whether or not they were well-intentioned or not, I think perhaps they probably did some good in some instances. I don't know enough about it, but I do know from hearing from at least from his account and some of the techniques they used on youth, especially in that vulnerable state, you know, is definitely worth a conversation. I don't know, that's another book there.
That is another book there. I'm not saying the entire staff at Daytop, don't get me wrong, but I think there's probably a few members of the staff that did take advantage of the vulnerability of some of the drug addicted youth that were there.
Sure.
And probably had their own little ring going on inside Daytop. And that's why I'm saying that in itself is kind of a topic that is well worth diving into. Fascinating stuff, Craig. It really is. And like I said, Carmine has such a rich, rich story here that you know, just when you think, well, there can't be more. And you know what? One of the things I want to ask you before we wrap up today is what do you think fueled Carmine's need for more and more hijinks and more run-ins with the law? It doesn't seem like as you go further and further down the pike here, it seems like there's this, you know, it's this classic angel and devil on the shoulder. You know, I want to get into trouble, but I don't want to get into too much trouble. You know, I'm willing to commit some crime, but I don't want it to be too severe a crime. You know, I'm willing to get my hands dirty, but not too dirty. What is it about Carmine that keeps him just this side of really being evil?
Yeah. That's great. That's a great topic. I look at we struggled with what we were going to name this book. We went through, you know, obviously hundreds of names. And I said, we'll find the right name. We just said, let's write the book and we'll come back to it. And then it just came, you know, Carmine and the 13th Avenue Boys. So back then, when I was growing up as well, it wasn't really gangs. It was neighborhood streets. It was 13th Avenue Boys, 18th Avenue Boys, the Bath Avenue Boys. So it was like this collective identity, this tribal culture. Mm-hmm. And Carmine was, I see Carmine with this exuberance. He's an extrovert. You know, he's a leader among men. He's the first one into the pitch. He's the first one. He's out in front. And I think he sees himself like that. And he doesn't see himself as a villain, even though he did some, you know, he was involved in criminal activity. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it has to do with, and he talks a lot about his father and he talks about integrity and loyalty. And I do see him as that. So I think that had a lot to do with, remember Brooklyn is in South Brooklyn back then it was much different place. It wasn't black and white. When your neighbor's a bookie, when your grandparents play the numbers, You know, when you see all this, it's easier to slide towards the other side, to slide into the dark than where it's not this sense of villainy. And, you know, before you know it, you're in deep. Carmine's sister also said Carmine always has a strong sense to once he's going to commit himself, he's going to commit himself and he's going to go full bore and get it done. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of this his self-identity, you know, his wrapped up into that. Well, that's what I say. I really enjoyed working with him. I consider him a close friend. Mm-hmm. It's amazing and amazing journey to go through for the last 2.5 years with Carmine and his wife and Tommy Dades. Really, Tommy Dades helped put us together. Tommy Dades, I was involved with a previous project. Tommy Dades, famous New York City detective. Mm-hmm. He's the one who broke the mafia cops case. Mm-hmm. And he knew Carmine since they were young men. So, you know, he brought, and again, nobody's making apologies here for anyone, you know. Yeah. Carmine's very, very, very blunt about that. You know, he's not looking to be held up, put on a pedestal, Tommy either. But by the same token, you know, the measure of the man, you know, he is a loyal man. He's a trustworthy man. He paid his debt to society. And Tommy's another one who has some great stories. I wish he'd do a book as well. He did do a book, the Mafia Cops, mm-hmm. but a book on Tommy's life would be fascinating too. Just such great characters.
So have you pitched it to Tommy doing a book on his life?
Yeah, I think he was involved in a couple and he was thinking about it, but he's a pretty busy guy.
I think you had to pitch him a little harder there.
I know, right?
Yeah. I think you could do it, Craig. I after having read this book about Carmine's life, I think you're the guy to do it. Absolutely. It's
thanks, Tim.
This is really a fascinating book. And folks, I want to encourage you to go out and get Carmine and the 13th Avenue Boys surviving the Colombo mob. It's I tell you, folks, you got to get your copy today. It is the Surviving Brooklyn's Colombo Mob is the name of the subtitle there. It's by Craig McGuire with Carmine Imbrioli. Folks, it is a fascinating book. It's a great read. It's one of those ones that you're not going to want to put down once you start reading it. It's really quite a fascinating read. Craig, I want to thank you for joining us today on True Crime Tuesday and really... I'm fascinated by this screenplay you've got going on. Can you say anything about it? Or
I want to keep that under wraps, Tim.
Okay.
You know, it was a minor caper. I was involved with some of my friends in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. That's really going to turn some heads because it had a lot of twists and turns. And,
okay.
We're working on that in the background.
Okay.
If you don't mind, I just want to thank the folks at Wild Blue Press.
Sure.
Mike, Steve, Ashley, Kelsey, just fantastic people. There's something exciting going on at Wild Blue Press. I encourage you to look at their titles, especially if you like true crime. Also, you know, my wonderful wife with me with all my craziness and my sons and just everybody who bought the book. I really appreciate it. Help me do what I love. And thank you, Tim. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
You're very welcome, Craig. And it was my pleasure. It was my pleasure, Craig. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and it was my pleasure to sit down and read it. And much success, much continued success with the book. I know it's already been doing well, but we want to encourage our audience to go out and buy more copies. That's for sure.
Yes.
That's for sure. All right. It's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.
truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs. In all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.